Luke 19, John 12, and the other parallel passages record the entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. We left him in Jericho, however. In Luke 19, 27, he finished the parable about the man who went to a distant country to receive a kingdom and then returned and rewarded his faithful servants and took care of his unfaithful servants, and then had those who did not want him to rule or reign over them taken away, bring them and slay them in my presence, which was a typical thing that a king in those days would do. David did it, killed his enemies in his presence, and so nothing gory about that, just typical of a king asserting his dominion and finalizing it. So that was the last we heard from Jesus in Jericho, and that was verse 27. And it said in 28, after he had said these things, he was going on ahead, ascending to Jerusalem. So that's his departure from Jericho. It's, like I said, something like a 1,500-foot incline or elevation gain from Jericho to Jerusalem. So when it says going, ascending to Jerusalem, it's quite literally the case. So we have Jesus now going to Jerusalem. How do you remember what we read in chapter 13? Herod said some people were warning Jesus not to go up to Jerusalem because Herod wanted to kill him. And Jesus said in verse 31, they said in 31, Pharisees, go away and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you. And he said to them, you go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I reach my goal. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem. So here back in chapter 13, Jesus said it was a three-day hike from wherever he was to Jerusalem. Now, don't take it that he meant that it would take 3 days to walk there if he just started walking. But he had things to do, people to cast in, miracles to perform, demons to cast out, people to teach on his way to Jerusalem. But that's 3 days from Luke 13, 31 to Luke 18, 31, Luke 19, 44. 3 days from Luke 13, 31 to Luke 19, 44, 3 days. So, just as a comparison and as a memory test, think about the material in Exodus 2. It's just a very short chapter. What happened in the first verses of Exodus 2? Moses was born. What happened in the last verses of Exodus 2? He's about ready to go to the burning bush. In less than 30 verses, 80 years of history. And here, in these few verses, only 3 days of history. So it's kind of an interesting thing to me, the way the Bible expands or contracts, depending upon the importance of the material. But Jesus has been on the road since the time that the Pharisees told him, don't go in, don't get out of here, Herod wants to kill you. I wonder if in saying that, again, that's, we talked about this back in chapter 13, but I wonder if in saying that they weren't testing him to see if he was focused or brave or what, or are you going to be play the coward or hide? And Jesus said, hey, you go tell that fox I'm coming. I'll be there in 3 days. And now here it is, 3 days later, but six chapters later, we're going to find Jesus coming into Jerusalem. So he's headed, verse 28, 19:28, he's headed toward Jerusalem. That is the lovely Zendaya that is giving us all those happy thoughts.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Okay, so that so much for review, bringing us up to speed. We're leaving Jericho, walking uphill to Jerusalem. And at verse 29, it came about that when he approached Bethphage and Bethany, don't ever say Bethphage. Don't say it that way, because the Greeks did not have that kind of diphthong, where you have the A, a vowel, and then E, like we do. Each vowel gets its own pronunciation. So I say Bethphage. I don't know what it actually is, but I know it's not Bethphage. All right. That's Americanizing it. And so Bethphage and Bethany. Rachel, isn't that a pretty name, Bethany? It's a lovely name. You know what it means? House of Misery.
That's what it means. So sad.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? House of Misery. Anyway, where is Bethany relative to Jerusalem? It's on the Mount of Olives, right?
Yeah,
it's on the Mount of Olives. Would you, Scott, turn over to Acts 1 and read verse 12? So we're going to just get a little bit of geography going on here, just for spatial reasons.
1:12?
Yeah, Acts 1:12. What's that say?
That says something.
It does say something. It's speaking to you right now.
And then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey.
A Sabbath day's journey. Mount Olivet was a Sabbath day's journey. That's where they were, in Bethany, which was on the Mount Olivet. What's a Sabbath day's journey? It's a man-made rule of how far the Jews were permitted to travel away from their property on the Sabbath. And it turned out to be about 7/8 of a mile, 3/4 to 7/8 of a mile. So it's not that far from Jerusalem, but I don't know. I put this together for myself this time. I don't know that I'd thought it through before, that this is the triumphal entry. You remember the palm branches and the coats? And we might think, well, just like from, you know, just a short way from the gate, it's a mile. They're laying down their coats and the palm branches for a whole mile to bring Jesus from where he was on into Jerusalem. Quite an entourage, quite a spectacle, spectacular. Anyway, there's that. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, and so he's coming from Jericho. He gets to the Mount Olivet, Bethany. He says, go, in verse 30, go into the village opposite you, in which, as you enter, you'll find a colt tied, on which no one yet has ever sat. Untie it and bring it. Now, anybody here ever got on the back of a horse? Anybody here ever got on the back of an unbroke horse? You have?
Yes.
What was it like?
It was like about 5 seconds.
5 seconds, yeah. Me too. My neighbor, when I was in high school, my neighbor had a horse. And he said, yeah, you, when we break it, you can ride it. I took that to mean I get to him. Mm-hmm. And so I got it over close to the fence and hopped on, or tried to hop on. I was lucky I didn't get my head kicked in. My dad got really upset with me one time because we had some calves that we were weaning, and had a friend over, and we got it in this pen inside the barn, and we'd just ride it out into the field, not realizing, man, that there's a lot of power in a little calf, and he could bash your head against the door jamb. But if you're on for 5 seconds, you know, you go to the rodeo. And so Jesus is going to get an unridden colt. And he's asking I want a colt on which no one has ever ridden. And I suppose that there are some religious people that can make some kind of pristine, like a tomb in which no man had ever laid, and a colt on which no man had ever ridden, and and make something supernatural or sensational or spectacular or worshipful out of it. I just look at it as saying, this is how I look at it, that a man who could calm the storm at sea could ride a colt that had never been ridden and ride it successfully. And so, anyway, any thoughts? And so he says, you're going to find a colt, untie it, and bring it. Now, okay, Rachel, here's the deal. There's a flatbed trailer out there. It's got a brand new Kawasaki dirt bike. I've never been ridden. It's somebody else's. Go bring it to me. And the guy who is pulling the trailer is in the truck. Go give me that Kawasaki and just bring it to me. I want to ride it. So these guys have been tasked with going into town and finding a colt tied up and just bring it. Yeah. And if the guy says, what are you doing? And you tell him the Lord needs it. Yep, for that mission? Not me. I mean, I don't know if I want to do that, because I'm not a confrontation type of person. And so, that's what you're going to do. And if anyone asks you, verse 31, why are you untying it? Speak thus, the Lord has need of it. And those who were sent went away. I'm glad to see there was more than one. This is a mission, more than one guy's going to go get this colt. So there was confidence in numbers. I know that. As I've frequently said, I'm really intimidated to go up to a door, just cold call, knock on it by myself. But if Linda were with me, I mean, look, how much power does she have? She's pretty tough, yeah. Hey! I would do it. It is just because there's company, you know. And so he says, and those who were sent went away and found it just as he had told them. Well, I don't want to make anything spectacular out of that. You know, maybe at a recon, maybe he saw the pictures from the drones flying over, and that he knew that there was a colt tied up there. But they found it just like he said they would. And as they were untying the colt, verse 33, its owners said to them, why are you untying the colt? How would you read that? I mean, hey, why are you untying the colt? Well, of course, they'd say it in Hebrew, and I can't do that. But it wouldn't be, oh, you're untying the colt, huh? Okay. There's some, I would hear some kind of challenge. And they said, the Lord has need of it. And the conversation ended there. They just brought it to Jesus, and they threw their garments on the colt and put Jesus on it. I found that interesting. It didn't say Jesus got on it. It says they put Jesus on it. You ever pick up on that, Scott? I mean, it's like the people are sensing something bigger than life going on here. And we're going to see massive crowds.
I was looking, they were expecting quite a show, I would think. That's why they put him on. They were holding the thing down and putting Jesus on him. They're expecting a show.
Can you stay on for 8 seconds? We're talking about getting on a colt that's never been ridden. Okay? 8 seconds, and then the belt. Well, yeah, maybe that. Maybe he asked them to. Maybe it's the way that royalty would be played. Why do I say royalty?
King of kings.
Well, yeah, but think more deeply. We just finished a study in the Minor Prophets.
Son of David.
In Zechariah 9, at verse 9. Pardon?
That's what they'll get.
In Zechariah 9, mm-hmm. verse 9. We read regarding the coming new order of things. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Who is the daughter of Zion? Pardon?
Israel.
The nation of Israel. The children of Israel. Rejoice greatly. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even a colt, the foal of a donkey. Now, when did Zechariah happen to say that? 500 years before Jesus was born, 530 years before Jesus was born. So this is 560, 570 years later, and lo and behold, this very prophecy is coming true right in front of them. Now, if any of them were paying attention to the prophets and paying attention to the signs of the times, I mean, when Jesus was born and when John the Baptist was born, didn't the people pay special attention and think in their head, what will this become? What will this child become? And there was a lot of excitement. And when Jesus started his public ministry, the first six chapters of John, when Jesus started his public ministry, they wanted to, after he fed the 5,000 in John 6, they wanted to take him by force and make him king. Okay, there was this anticipation, excitement. Now, his popularity started going down when he rejected that offer. He didn't want to be king on their terms. He didn't want to be the kind of king they were expecting. He wanted to be the kind of king they needed. Okay, but there's a growing excitement. And this is not the only prophecy concerning Zion. And your king is coming into Zion riding on a colt. I want to read also from Isaiah chapter 59. You want to pick up on this. This is really a significant promise. I'm going to start halfway through verse 15. Isaiah 59:15. Now Yahweh saw, and it was displeasing in his sight, that there was no justice. And he saw that there was no man, that he meant by that no man that could accomplish justice for his people. And he was astonished that there was no one to intercede. God's people were being destroyed by their sins, and nobody could make a difference, and God was astonished. Then his own right arm brought salvation to him, and his righteousness upheld him. And he put on righteousness like a breastplate. By the way, when I'm reading this, think of the armor of God in Ephesians. He put on armor, he put on righteousness like a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself with zeal as a mantle. According to their deeds, so he will repay. You think of what Paul said about judgment in 1 Corinthians, that we'll all stand, he said, before the judgment seat of God to receive, no, that's 2 Corinthians, to receive in our bodies, to receive the thing done in the body, whether good or evil. He will repay wrath to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies. To the coastal ones he will make recompense. I'm thinking also of Deuteronomy 32, where Moses talked about what would happen in the last days of Israel, that these things would transpire and take place. So, verse 19, by the way, when it says coastal ones, what do you think of?
He says what?
In verse 18, to the coastal ones he will make recompense.
Everywhere else.
Well, think of the Mediterranean Sea, which mm-hmm. is what they knew. Yeah. And so the nations that surrounded Israel on the coasts.
Philistines?
It might be the Philistines, but it probably would be even beyond the Philistines.
Everyone else,
yeah,
basically.
Anybody out there in the Mediterranean that did business with them? Okay. And so, verse 19, so they will fear the name of Yahweh from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun. Where did the sun rise? Where does the sun rise today?
East.
In the east, from the west to the east. All right? That's not, by the way, the only time that Isaiah says that. It's a really important concept. So they will fear the name of Yahweh from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun, for he will come like a rushing stream, the wind of Yahweh driving, and a redeemer will come to Zion. To those who turn from transgression in Jacob, declares Yahweh. So when the Redeemer comes to Zion, and we read over Romans 11, a phrase that is, I think, frequently misunderstood. And so all Israel will be saved. That's understood, meaning God has a universal salvation plan for the Jews. But what it's really saying is, like when they believe and are grafted back in, this is the way in which all Israel will be saved. Okay? So it's not talking about universal salvation, it's talking about those who would, what does it say here, turn from transgression. Those who turn from transgression in Jacob, declares the Lord. And as for me, this is my covenant with them, says the Lord, or says Yahweh, my spirit which is upon you, and my words which I put in your mouth shall not depart from your mouth, nor from the mouth of your offspring, nor from the mouth of your offspring's offspring, says Yahweh, from now on and forever. I'm going to establish an everlasting covenant when the Redeemer comes to Zion. And so, try to get what I'm trying to do is develop in your mind what it might have been like to have been one of those citizens of Judah at this point in time. Here comes Jesus. He's riding on a donkey, just like Zechariah predicted. And he's coming having done so many marvelous things, just like the prophet said, when you see these things, you know that this is the one I'm sending. And so here they are, seeing this. And let's go back now to our Luke reading, Luke 19 and verse 35. They brought it to Jesus. They threw their garments on the colt, put Jesus on, and as he was going, they were spreading their garments in the road. And as he was now approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives. Now, if you've seen the picture, we passed these out earlier, you've seen the picture of the Mount of Olives, it's quite a ridge to the east of Jerusalem, about a mile away. And so there's the descent that comes down to the plain upon which Jerusalem, now Jerusalem was up in the mountains, but it's still a flat, fairly flat area, a few mountains like Moriah and Zion and that in the area, but they're coming down the descent from Bethany to go into the city. So that's why I'm confident. I had never considered it this way before, Alan, that the spreading of the palm branches and the coats and the cloaks was a mile long. I mean, it wasn't just the last few feet before he entered Jerusalem like I'd always pictured it. And maybe that's all I've ever seen in drawings of it. But this started a mile away, and they're doing it all along the way. What does that tell you? Well, draw any conclusions you can from that.
Well, there's a lot of people there.
Yeah, that's my biggest one. A lot of people thronging the road. Remember, in Jericho, Zacchaeus had to climb up into a tree to see Jesus as he walked down the street. That is a way to establish in your mind just how popular he was at this time. How in demand to be seen. And so here's this, I don't want to call it a parade route, but that might be what it's like. But the official, what do they call it when they take the president from the airport to whatever place he's going to be? The route. Yeah. The route, okay? That's what this is, the route. And thronged with people. Okay, so it says, and as he was approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen. So, just get the picture. I was a little more, how should we say, less polished in my translation of this, but it captured for me the essence of it. Where is it? And the entire fullness of the rejoicing disciples, this whole mass of disciples. There's a word for crowd, but this word is the fullness. Everybody was there and rejoicing, and they began to praise God in a great voice. This could be heard probably in the courts of the naysayers, Why do I say that? The naysayers probably heard this and were probably disturbed by it.
Yeah.
You know,
they were.
I'm really intrigued by the opposition to a certain mindset that if you're posting online on a community bulletin board, you're posting a thought that they think is politically incorrect, the first thing they want to do is have you banned. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to discuss it. They don't want to have they don't want to have an opportunity for competing ideologies to meet and to be refined by each other. We just don't want to hear it. We just don't want to hear it. That person ought to be banned. That person ought to be kicked off, or get their own little cubby hole where they can post what they want to post. Nobody will see it, so it won't bother us. But that mindset that we don't want to deal with having to discuss the opposing viewpoint or defend ours. They just shut them up. And isn't that what they were trying to do to Jesus? Just shut him up. And so here we've got this cacophony is a bad word here to use. That means evil voice, evil noise, a racket. But it was a loud noise, a great voice, a great upswelling of praise to God, because this guy, this Jesus, he's coming into town and he's coming riding on a donkey. And Zechariah said our king would come riding on a donkey, and he's done all these miracles like Isaiah predicted that the Messiah would do, and he's coming. And they were excited. And here's what they're saying in verse 38. Blessed is the king who comes in the name of Yahweh. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Remember what the angel said when Jesus was born? Peace on earth and toward men of God's goodwill. Yeah, not toward men in general, but peace on earth toward men with whom God is pleased. And so here, they're saying the same thing 3 years later. No, 33 years later. Saying the same thing, essentially. But where did that come from? You notice if you look in your Bible, it's mine at least is this way. It's typeset so that it's all uppercase letters. Rachel, do you know why they call them uppercase and lowercase?
Because the uppercase gives more prominence to it, I guess?
No, it's much more simple than that. They called uppercase because in the old typesetting world, all the capital letters were put in the uppercase and all the lower letters were put in the lowercase. And so you have the capital A and small a. Capital A was put in the uppercase, small a was put in the lowercase. So when we say it's all in uppercase letters, it means all what we would call capital letters, but, you know, very few of them. But what does that mean when you see it in your Bible?
It's from the Old Testament.
That means it's a citation, a direct quotation from somewhere in the Old. And you might notice, I don't know if it's that this way in yours, but in mine, blessed is the king who comes in the name of Yahweh. That's all uppercase. But the next line isn't. Mm-hmm. It's just lowercase letter. But it's part of their praise. Okay? Now, any idea, if that's in uppercase letters, where that came from? Anybody know? Anybody got a guess? Anybody check your marginal reference?
Psalm 118.
Now everybody's familiar with Psalm 118 because we've got this very famous quotation. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. You see that everywhere. Almost nobody knows what it means. Almost everybody thinks we're talking about today. This is a special day today. But that's not what it was talking about. It was talking about the day that the stone was placed. The day that God began building on his stone. That's the day that we should rejoice and be glad. And let's go read this. Psalm 118. I'm going to read more than just the one verse. I think you'll see why. Psalm 118. I'm going to start in verse 19. Open to me the gates of righteousness. Now we read Zechariah 9. Isaiah 59. We read Isaiah 59, and we talked about how that the deliverer would come to Zion and open up righteousness. Here we're talking about the same event. Open to me the gates of righteousness. I shall enter through them. I shall give thanks to Yahweh. This is the gate of Yahweh. The righteous will enter through it. Remember Isaiah 59? It was the deliverer came to turn to those who turned to righteousness, that turned away from lawlessness and turned to righteousness. The righteous shall enter through it. Here in verse 21, I shall give thanks to you, for you have answered me and you have become my salvation. The stone which the builders rejected. Now, do you know from the New Testament anything about a stone rejected by the builders?
Yeah.
Didn't Peter say in Acts 3 to the religious leaders, he is the stone, Jesus is the stone which was rejected by you, the builders. He identified which builders this psalm is talking about, the spiritual leaders in the days of Jesus. This is the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief corner. This is the Lord's doing. It's marvelous in our eyes. This is the day the Lord, Yahweh, has made. Let's rejoice and be glad in it. You see what I'm saying? The day that Yahweh has made is the day that he laid down that cornerstone that built his eternal temple. Okay? This is the day that Yahweh has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. O Yahweh, do save, we beseech you. O Yahweh, we beseech you, do send prosperity. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of Yahweh. That's what the people were saying. But you see, it's drawn out of this entire narrative here in Psalm 118. The whole picture comes with the one statement, that they're seeing that God is now laying down a stone for his eternal. They didn't understand it, but they saw it. I mean, they knew that this is what this is referring to. And they're excited about it. We have blessed you in the house of Yahweh. Yahweh is our God, and he has given us light. Yeah. Bind the festal sacrifice with the cords to the horns of the altar. You are my God. I give thanks to you. My God, I extol you. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good, and his loving kindness is everlasting. This is the kind of praise that was, what did it say, a mighty voice? That was a mighty voice, a great, magnificent voice. I mean, I don't know if the whole mile long of people was doing that, but I can imagine that it was quite an upwelling of praise that wasn't just, okay, there, yeah, we give thanks in the name of the Lord, and he walks by and I'm done. I can't picture it that way. Can you? That this was an exciting, to the point where, back on Psalm Luke 19 now, to the point where, verse 39, and some of the Pharisees in the multitude. So we've got some looky-loos along with it, not people who are involved in the praise, but maybe sniffing it out or maybe getting a sense or a feel for what it was like. So we have
these people here.
Pardon?
What are all these people?
Yeah! And not only that, why aren't you telling them to shut up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they know what they're saying.
Oh, yeah.
The Pharisees knew what they were implying.
You got that right. The Pharisees knew exactly what these guys were saying, and it wasn't what they wanted them to say. And it wasn't what, because who was it that set the stone aside? We're not going to build God's temple on this stone.
The builders.
You, the builders. Peter said, you, the builders, rejected, and he's become the chief corner anyway. They didn't want what Jesus was offering. They wanted what they wanted. Now, that's a real important point for all of us to think about. Because every one of us, as we study our Bible, if we study it honestly, we study it openly, we're going to realize I misunderstood that in the past. I didn't grasp that meaning right there. And then our hearts will be on trial of whether or not we're willing to lay that old meaning aside and embrace the new. You'll be challenged with that your entire life. Who was it that rejected Jesus? And what did it cost them to reject Jesus?
It cost them everything.
Cost them everything. Well, why did they do it?
Because it didn't fit their paradigm.
It didn't fit their paradigm. I tell you what, Rachel, I wouldn't give 20 cents for your paradigm. It ain't worth it. Okay?
Well, that was a joke.
Paradigm.
I've been making that joke for probably longer than Rachel's been alive. All right. And some of the Pharisees in the multitude said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." It's like the gal on Next Door yesterday. Somebody had posted something about Memorial Day. He said, "Isn't it ironic to be memorializing those who fought for the rights that we're losing?" And I thought, you know, well said, but unfortunately true, you know, something like that. Some gal came on and says, there's no place for this on this venue. This kind of hatred has to go. And I wrote back and said, this is a strange definition of hatred. This woman was expressing sadness and they're calling it hatred? You're not projecting, are you? I haven't heard back from her, but you get that. If it disagrees with where I am, shut up and don't post it. Tell your disciples to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we're hearing things we don't want to hear. And our culture is full of that. If it's not what is politically correct, or I guess that politically correct is no longer politically
just
correct, is it? Now
hear.
It's woke. Now it's woke. Okay. But it's the same old thing. If you don't agree with the majority,
right,
then you don't have a right to have a voice. And that's what they're telling Jesus. And look at Jesus' response. Okay. Jesus said, "I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out." Wow. If these become silent, the stones will cry out. Didn't Jesus say something like that earlier, that I'm able to raise up from these stones offspring to Abraham? Where did he say that? Remember? You remember him saying that? Or am I making that up in my head? I just now thought of it, so I didn't have a chance to look it up. But
ask Siri.
Well,
she knows.
Siri knows everything. I want to just keep going on. You all can
sure
look that up.
Sure, she does.
She's a woman, isn't she? She's got to know everything.
That doesn't mean anything.
All right. And so, if I tell you, if these become silent, well, what do you make out of that statement, verse 40? If I tell these guys to shut up, or if they, because they're intimidated by you, and they shut up, and they don't express the truth as they see it, the stones will cry out. What do you make out of that verse?
John said something similar.
Did he? What did he say?
He said, "You think you're the sons of Abraham? God could make these stones the sons of Abraham."
Yeah, that's the one I was just mentioning.
Yeah, that's John said it, and yeah, he did say it. Yeah, yeah. So that's what I think. I think
was said.
It was said. We have Alan's word that it was said.
It's got to be in Mark.
I don't remember where it is right off the top of my head. But still, what do you make out of the statement? If these become silent, the stones will cry out. What's the feeling or the sense that you get from that? Not parallel passages or what, just the sense that you that comes to you from that. Boy, my screen is deadly silent tonight.
That there's nothing that they can do about it, like, no matter.
Well, yeah. First of all, how can the stones cry out without the power of God?
Yeah.
I mean, but there's this, yeah.
Well, it's obviously a figure of speech,
yeah.
Hyperbole. Okay.
Yeah, there's nothing that can stop it.
That's it. Nothing that can stop it. Glenn, go ahead, Glenn.
Looked that phrase up, it's in Habakkuk 2:11.
Yeah, yeah. I looked at that passage. It's a little bit different. That's the woes against King Nebuchadnezzar and his attitudes. So I didn't connect that to this because the context is different, but that it is stated there. The stones cry out. But that would be the house that he was building inappropriately would testify against him or cry out against him. What I take from this is somewhat like what Rachel said, that you can't keep this message down. You try to shut it up over here, and this guy, how many ping pong balls can you hold underwater at the same time? They're going to pop up. They have to come up. This praise has to come. See, that, yeah, Ken's got to figure it out. She just take a piece of mesh and pull them all down. But you see the point I'm making, that these things just have to come up. And you can't keep them down. You can't repress them. You can't suppress them. They're going to rise because this is God's doing. And this is the stone that the builders are going to reject, but God's going to place it in Zion anyway. This is the king coming on a colt. This is salvation for Jerusalem, and you have to be filled with praise. It doesn't matter that you guys don't recognize it or acknowledge it. That's just too bad.
I guess I could also kind of see it as a challenge, too. Like, just go ahead and let these people praise him, because you don't want to see what happens if you try to shut them up.
you're not off on that, Alan. Let's keep reading. And verse 41, and when he approached, he saw the city and wept over it. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you? Do you remember any other place where Jesus wept?
Death.
The death of his friend Lazarus, the grief that he felt, the loss that he felt. Here, this city, what was this city? It's Jerusalem. What was this city?
It was supposed to be the seat of God.
It was the singular city on the whole globe where God met with man. The temple was there. It was the city of David. It was this jewel of God's creation. And Jesus is weeping over it, saying, if you had known in this day, if today you knew, even you, the things that make for peace. What kind of things make for peace? Remember the angels, peace on earth, and with men of God's good pleasure. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Peace on earth toward men of God's goodwill. Peace. Peace. What things make for peace? If you knew the things that make for peace, what are those things?
God's law, God's love.
To do justice and righteousness.
Compassion.
Given what we just read from Psalm 118, what was it that was happening? It starts with R. The stone which the builders rejected.
Rejected?
The rejection of God. The rejection of God's ways. You don't know the things that make for peace. We read, I think, in this class, it might have been in the Matthew study, that the Pharisees rejected God's will for them by not being baptized. By John. They rejected God's righteousness. And so there's I'm coming with the message. And here's a really interesting thing, Candy. That this message Jesus came with was a message that was fulfilling, as we've tried to present a little bit here tonight. The excitement was the message of the prophets is coming to a culmination. The promise of the prophets is being focused right here at this point in time. But the prophets were there 600, 700, 800 years before Jesus. The prophets were there telling what God was going to do. You go all the way back to Moses, 1,500 years before Jesus. telling what God was going to do. It was there. It wasn't a secret. It wasn't hidden from them from the standpoint of it being predicted and promised. But they didn't see it. And that raises the question, why didn't they see it? But Jesus, I mean, this crowd is, what was the loud voice praising God for? Up in verse 37.
Miracles.
The miracles which they had seen. What's a miracle?
Sign.
It's a sign. It's a mighty work. I mean, miracle means mighty work. Wonder means that's the feeling that you get by seeing, wow, how could a man do that? Well, isn't a man, that's the sign of it. This is not just a man, this is God. This is God bringing his promises. God bringing his promises to fulfillment in their lifetime. If you had seen this day, that it was right there, blossoming in front of them, and they couldn't see it. But now they have been hidden from your eyes. Did God put blinders on these people so that they couldn't see it? It says hidden. They have been hidden from your eyes. Why? How?
Because of their hearts.
Heart.
Because of their heart.
Heart. Heart. Expectation. What you're saying differs from my expectation. Compare Bereans with Thessalonians in Acts 17. These were more noble-minded than those at Thessalonica because they listened readily and examined the scriptures to see whether or not it's right. Very simple process. But these are hidden because what I'm saying disagrees with what you're expecting. And we're not going to examine deeply to see, are my expectations wrong? Do you suppose you have any inaccurate expectations? Any inaccurate conclusions about the work of God? I find myself correcting opinions still. And so, but a person who's unwilling to say, I got it wrong, will never see it right. A person, I just made that up, but it's so good. A person who's unwilling to say, I got it wrong, will never see it right. I need to write that down. I'm going to save that thought. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Make it understood.
Now, he says, you aren't going to have peace. Your eyes are closed. By the way, compare this to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 about the veil being over their eyes at the reading of Moses. Yeah. It's lifted with Christ, and they couldn't see that. Mm-hmm. All right. But he says, the peace hidden from your eyes, verse 43, for the days shall come upon you when your enemies will throw up a bank before you. What do you mean, throw up a bank before you? Now, I like to go to the bank, don't you? Alan, what's he talking about? Pardon?
He's talking about an enclosure, like a bank.
A siege wall.
A siege wall, yeah.
A bank that they could hide behind and throw missiles at. And so it's talking about being invaded. And surround you and hem you in on every side and will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Now this word visitation is the same word that's used in the Bible for overseer or bishop. Episcopos. That's where you get the word Episcopalian. But you see the word scope and epi, to be an overseer. God came down to see what was going on. And you didn't recognize that he was about to come down and see what's going on. When does God come down to see what's going on? At what point in a nation's or a city's history does God come down to see what's going on?
Judgment.
No, well, that's what's going to happen. But at what point does he do it? There's a better word, Mary. You're right, but there's a better word. How about corruption?
I was going to say reprobate.
Reprobate. Yeah, to where a nation is so corrupt that they're no longer fit to exist. Like when God came down to see what was going on with Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. you didn't recognize the time of your visitation. You didn't recognize that I'm about to come and see what's going on here and do something about it. And because, and how does a nation like the United States not see the levels of corruption in society, in entertainment, in the school systems, especially in the university system? How do people in this country not see that? Right? And Jesus said, because you don't see it.
Well, you know,
go ahead.
You don't have eyes behind your head. In the back of your head, they've turned.
My mother did.
They've turned their back on God.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't see.
Romans 1 is very, very clear. Because they did not acknowledge Him as God or give thanks, started the downward spiral. Okay, and so that's what's going on here in Jerusalem. As Jesus is walking into it, He's not walking into this beautiful, pristine city. If we want to go with the physical picture, He's walking into a ghetto. He's walking into a slumlord's dream. The filth and corruption, and He's about to go into the temple. Better get on to that. And so you didn't recognize, and the evidence is there for us to see what the nature of our society is like. And I want to say something really clear to everybody on the screen and in the room and whoever listens to these recordings. If God's people don't make it clear that God's visitation is coming, the people outside of God aren't going to know. I mean, they've already normalize their way of life, and it's up to us to be the beacon. Okay, because you didn't recognize the day of your visitation, so He entered the temple. Now, He said, because you didn't recognize it, what's going to happen is everything's going to be torn down. Now, if He had recognized it, you could have done something about it, but because you didn't recognize it, you know, let it go to the point where it's so corrupt it has to be scraped and rebuilt. He entered the temple and began to cast out those who were selling. You know what's going on in the temple? The selling. The temple had become an emporium. It should have been a place where God and man came to God, man devoted to God and God blessing man. But instead, they saw an opportunity to make money.
Turned it into a marketplace.
He turned it into a corrupt marketplace. He calls it in one place an emporium here, in another place a den of thieves.
Yes.
And just, they had corrupted God's sanctity, His set apartness, can I say it that way? To where it was just an opportunity to get rich off of God. And so he says, it is written, my house shall be a house of prayer. He was casting, and it doesn't go into detail here like he does. See, this is the second time that Jesus did this, at least. Did you know that? In John 2, at the beginning of His ministry, Jesus cleansed the temple, and there was a lot more detail. In John 12, it is parallel to this. That's the triumphal entry, and that's what this is. There's this 3 years later, a cleansing of the temple, and He might have done it more often than that, but we're just not told. Okay? My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you've made it a robber's den, a den of thieves, an emporium. And He was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and leading men among the people were trying to destroy Him. I mean, think about it. Who's leading the people of Jerusalem? Following the leader. I need to get in front of these people. They're supposed to be following me. Got to get rid of that guy. Mm-hmm. See, that's what's going on with it. They couldn't find anything that they might do, for all the people were hanging upon His words. They couldn't find anything anyway because of His popularity. But also, there was nothing that He was saying or doing that they could charge Him with a crime. Any thoughts? To me, that's just an exciting chapter of watching Jesus come in, watching the people getting all excited, and then in all that excitement, Jesus is crying because he knows what's about to happen to these people.
What?
Yes. Yes, Jim.
So it's 47. He was teaching daily in the temple. Was that so? How many days?
Well,
teaching in the temple for 2 or 3 days.
From the time that he entered Jerusalem till the time he was crucified, according to John, 7 days. I believe that's correct. And so, he's there. But see, that part of that is what we're going to see. I think next week is that the leaders say we need to kill him, but not on the feast day. Okay. When did they kill him?
On the feast day.
On the feast day. What we're going to see is Jesus is in complete control over this whole process. He's not being pushed or nudged or carried along by other people's intents. He has his schedule. He's keeping his schedule. He's doing his thing because, after all, he is God. And we're just men. All right. Next week, we'll pick up chapter 20. And we get into some of the sad stuff of Jesus' trials and Isaiah is very, very clear that his rights were taken away. He did not get a fair trial. But Alan, I want to tell you this from man to man, heart to heart. I'm excited that he didn't get a fair trial, because if he did, he wouldn't have been killed. And if he hadn't been killed, I couldn't be saved. So it's just another example of how God can use men's hostility and bless people through it. Yes, Mary.
I just wanted to thank you. You presented several things and ideas this evening that I had just totally misread. I mean, not misread, but just kind of glossed over and didn't think about. And
I appreciate hearing that.
Class, thank you.
Appreciate hearing that. I prayed to God ahead of time that it would make a difference, and glad that it did.